broadcast out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, May 6, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Mondays of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm and DrSaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we got another great show for you today that's going to include what is L-carnitine and how does it prevent death after a heart attack?
And what kind of stresses increase the risk for a heart attack?
When you reduce the complications in hospitals, it may cost them money.
And why don't doctors care about medical costs?
And how do doctors learn about new drugs?
Well, we just had Cinco de Mayo, and now we're on, however you say, six. And
the day after.
The day after. So ever heard of L-carnitine? You know, if you've had a heart attack, we hope that you've heard of this energy-producing amino acid because it's really important to replenish it after the heart attack depletes it. And many studies have shown that L-carnitine decreases all-cause mortality, cardiac arrhythmias, angina, and that decreases the size of a heart attack and can probably even prevent recurrences of heart attacks and congestive heart failure. So why is this basically harmless nutritional supplement not routinely used in mainstream medicine?
Well, it's the same story over and over again, Vicki. I got about an hour of nutritional training in medical school. And it's not changed much since that time. And that was a long time ago when I went to school. And what we have is a system that basically is looking at using drugs to solve health issues rather than looking at cellular biochemistry and try and support wellness in the body. And if we don't think of things that way, it simply doesn't come to mind that there's a whole area of cellular metabolism that produces energy that's vitally important.
You know, we are in a drug culture, and in mainstream medicine, the meds, with their often adverse effects, really are usually the first choice, even if the supplement's appropriate and a safer choice.
Well, how would a doctor even know? I mean, if they're not trained in cellular biochemistry, they don't have a training in something called orthomolecular medicine, which is an organization in this country that has probably about 1,000 people who are members of it, and focus on how do the nutrients that we get in our food or should be getting in our food manage the biochemistry of our cells so we have enough energy to produce the products we have to be healthy.
So how does L-carnitine work for the health of the heart besides producing energy?
Well, that's the biggest thing that it does. I mean, it does other things, but the biggest thing it does is it transports long-chain fatty acids, the fats that are in our body, into the mitochondria, which is where we produce ATP. Now, remember, gasoline runs a car, ATP runs our cells. If you can't take these high-energy fats and get them into the cell and into the mitochondria, which is where most of our ATP is made, then you're not going to be able to make enough ATP to sustain a healthy environment. And if our heart is in trouble because it's had a heart attack and it doesn't get blood flow that it needs to a vital area where it's dying, L-carnitine can do something really important to try and produce more energy in those areas if there's enough L-carnitine there. Because, frankly, the L-carnitine gets used up when we have a heart attack, and then there's not enough there. Then we can't transport those long-chain fatty acids into the mitochondria to produce the large amounts of ATP that mitochondria produce.
So L-carnitine is also works as an antioxidant. And we get it in our diet from meat. Basically, we get the most of it from beef. Mm-hmm. And there's some other types of meat we can get some, and there's like just small amounts in codfish and chicken and dairy, but the main source is beef. So if someone is a vegetarian, it probably is advisable to take a supplement.
Well, the nice thing is you can measure it. You can measure the level of L-carnitine. And if it's low,
will most doctors do that for you?
Well, they don't even know what it is.
And will insurance companies pay for it?
They will. I mean, I've seen that happen. Yes. And there's a lot of data showing that L-carnitine is really important after a heart attack. I mean, this isn't something that's brand new. I mean, this was a study that was published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings in April of 2013. And basically what they did is they reviewed 13 controlled studies, nearly 4,000 patients that involved 250 deaths, 220 new cases of heart failure, 38 recurrent heart attacks, and they found that L-carnitine was associated with a 27% reduction in all-cause mortality, that there was a 65% reduction in those ventricular rhythm disturbances that cause cardiac arrest, so that people are dying from it, a 40% reduction in the development of chest pain, angina, and it reduced the size of the heart attack.
So if you've had a heart attack or you have angina,
yeah,
it's probably a good idea to just ask your doctor if they would please do an L-carnitine level on you.
I would,
and
as
maybe,
a doctor, I would just give it. I wouldn't even measure
it. No, but you just said that most doctors don't do it.
No, I know, but
this
if you're talking...
This is why it's good for patients to learn about their health.
It depends on the setting, Vicki. If you've got somebody who's an outpatient and they're wondering if they're in congestive heart failure, they're having angina, you're wondering, is L-carnitine something that's important? You should measure it to find out if it's low, and then give it. But in the case of somebody coming in with acute heart attack, just give it. I mean, it's not going to hurt anything, and it's going to support the production of energy in a better way in very critical areas.
Okay. Well, I was just trying to say that if the doctor doesn't, this is where it's good for the patient to know.
Right.
So they can ask the doctor if they've done that level or if they would please give them some.
Exactly.
But can you get it in the hospital?
Well, that's a good question. Probably not.
So maybe to keep it in your first aid kit along with your aspirin.
Well,
you know?
Yeah. And that brings up a great point. I mean, when you have chest pain that tells you you're probably having a heart attack or something like it, yes, take the aspirin by all means, but also take the L-carnitine, because that may do something that's really impressive as well. In fact, you could take a little fish oil, and you could take a little coenzyme Q10 as well, because they all are important in various aspects of preventing a heart attack.
You know, what's interesting is that these researchers that wrote this article and did this study were recommending L-carnitine if the patient's medicines failed.
I know. Isn't that the silliest thing? But you have to keep in mind that they're doctors. And doctors do what? They're used to using drugs. And so the point of view that they take is, well, we'll do the usual things that we do because basically they don't want to have the risk of saying that we don't need to do these other things and that the supplements are maybe not nearly as important. But when they don't know, they take the safe way out. And my approach is if you're on an ACE inhibitor, fine, take it. If you're on a beta blocker, that's fine too. Continue taking it because it may do a lot to prevent your congestive heart failure and may do a lot to help keeping your heart functioning so you don't have chest pain or rhythm disturbances. That's important. But adding carnitine, that's, I mean, insane not to. Same thing with coenzyme Q10.
Yeah, I was going to ask about where do coenzyme Q10 and fish oil fit in here?
Yeah, see, coenzyme Q10 is vital to produce ATP as well. And if we don't have enough ATP, our whole system shuts down. The whole body shuts down. Every cell needs to make ATP. If there's not enough ATP, tissues don't work. They close down and you're basically in a potentially life-threatening situation.
So what's the difference between L-carnitine and CoQ10 then?
They produce energy in different ways.
Okay.
And so the CoQ10 is a real issue because most patients who are heart patients are on statins.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're on a statin,
that
you've blocked the production of coenzyme Q10 just as you block the production of cholesterol. So everybody who's a heart patient who's on a statin drug at the very minimum should have a coenzyme Q10 level drawn. And if not, just take a couple of 100 milligrams a day of coenzyme Q10 because it's going to help you produce energy a little bit better, particularly if the levels are low, and it's not going to hurt you if your levels are fine.
I think it's also good to note here about fish oil because
right.
It also has been shown to be effective with cardiac arrhythmias.
Absolutely.
And also as an anticoagulant.
It's beautiful stuff. You know, we've got so many powerful approaches in nutritional medicine to support what happens
and they're
to
safe.
Prevent disease. They absolutely are safe. I mean, people are saying, well, the fish oil may make you bleed. Well, sure. It may have a slight very slight increase in your risk for bleeding. But it's
compare
do
that.
Nothing.
Compare it to Coumadin.
Yeah, or Xarelto, or some of the other new Pradaxa, the new anticoagulants that are out there. Now those are dangerous. In fact, there is no remedy if you're on something like Xarelto or on Pradaxa, because there's no way to stop the bleeding if you're in an accident or you have an overdose or something goes wrong.
Yeah, and if you're on it, you should tell your doctors. And if you're going to have surgery, it's probably better to kind of cut back on the fish oil.
Oh, yeah, you don't want to...
Ginkgo biloba or anything else like that.
Right, you don't want to take the risk of having a complication at surgery. But for people who are not at surgery, I mean, that's why I don't recommend aspirin for my patients. And a lot of cardiologists think that's insane, but... Basically, those cardiologists have not researched fish oil, and they should. It's a very, very powerful anti-arrhythmic agent, which is a big issue for people who have heart disease. The rhythm disturbances are the cause of death a lot of time when you have a heart attack, not just the heart failure.
That's when you get defibrillated.
That's when you get, that's
hopefully.
Right. Well, that's right. Hopefully, if there's one there, that's right.
Okay, now back to L-carnitine. Uh-huh. Can it interact with medications? Well, I know that I was reading that it can slow blood clotting too much if you're taking an anticoagulant.
It may be a minor effect there, but it certainly isn't one that's a major effect.
So anyway, if you're taking an anticoagulant, you might want to check with your doctor before you take the L-carnitine.
Well, I mean, it's fair enough that your doctor should know what you're taking. The problem is your doctor, if he's an average doctor, isn't going to have a clue what this does. And you can collect the literature. I mean, go to drsaputo.com and get the URLs to some of the fast tracks we have on this topic and send them to your doctor, and he can listen to us talk about that. And then, of course, he can always do, or she could do, a Google search to try and learn something more about it.
Well, the other thing about L-carnitine is that it may decrease your thyroid. And
well,
that's just something good to be aware of.
It is, but
if you're hypothyroid.
You could look at the use of it for people who have hyperthyroidism. It's a very well-kept secret that people who have thyroid storm, which means they have an incredibly overactive thyroid gland, which can actually be life-threatening. If you'll give them 2 to 4 grams of L-carnitine, you'll actually protect against the dangers of hyperthyroid crisis.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think it's just good to note, because this is a nutritional supplement, and it's usually better if you take it under the supervision of a healthcare practitioner
who understands it.
But yeah, some medications can actually decrease L-carnitine, like the seizure medication valproic acid.
Right. Right. Well, that's right.
And once in a while, there can be some mild side effects, a little nausea and vomiting, maybe an upset stomach, you know, that kind of thing.
These are highly uncommon.
And it can also sometimes cause a fishy odor, like in your urine or your breath or your sweat. But this is rare, and it's just something just to know about, because we want to, you know, be sure to let you know of everything that there is a possibility of. But when you compare this to some of the medications, it's like nothing.
Oh, for sure. I mean, this is an exceptionally safe treatment to use compared to a medication. It also has other effects that are not well known, things like its effect on bone mass. For people who have osteoporosis, L-carnitine is a good thing to consider using, because what it does is it increases the level of serum osteocalcin, which is something that helps osteoblasts lay down new bone. So what it's basically saying is that L-carnitine can help prevent osteoporosis and can actually stimulate the production of new bone. So it's good for that.
It's good for fatigue, too.
In some people, it is, if you don't have enough energy. That's right. And then you can look at things like asthma. There have been some studies on people who have asthma. And when they've supplemented these people, kids who have it, and put on it for about 6 months, they showed a statistically measurable improvement in the amount of asthma that they got, as well as in pulmonary function. So we're looking at things that can be really pretty impressive when it comes to using this supplement.
It's good for leg circulation, too.
It may be.
And so, for athletic performance, Lyme disease, ADHD, male infertility,
I think any
brain
condition,
function.
Any condition where you have a low carnitine level, it's beneficial to increase the level of carnitine. And measuring it is not a complicated thing. I measure it all the time in my office. And when levels are low and you replace it, it can make a big difference in how people feel. the basic thing we have to keep in mind is that this is a powerful, basically amino acid. It's an amino acid that is able to do important things in energy production. And when we don't have a background, as we don't in the medical profession, in nutritional medicine or cellular biochemistry, we're at a big disadvantage for using integrative approaches that can all help in supporting what we need to have to be able to avoid the use of medicines that have so many side effects that lead to about 400,000 deaths a year. I mean, that's a staggering number. And you compare that to the number of deaths from supplements and herbs, like 50 a year. We're many decimal points different here. So it's really imperative that we change our medical school training. It must include more about nutritional medicine. We need to understand the simple things that we can do to restore the basic deficiencies that can cause disease, because if we don't have enough of the raw materials that we need to make the products that our body needs to make energy and to repair itself and to have the hormones and enzymes and other nutrients that perform very important functions, we can't be well.
Well, there are many alternatives that are very helpful for heart disease. Everything from body work to good nutrition to meditation and biofeedback and psychotherapy and acupuncture and hypnotherapy.
Sure, the list goes on.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about more of that later in the show. We've got some other topics.
All of it. Yeah. Well, a healthy lifestyle.
It's vital. And what we need to see in today's healthcare is a shift from this disease care model we have to one that's a health care model that's looking at wellness and prevention that's based on a healthy lifestyle. It's diet, exercise, stress, sleep, weighing what you should, avoiding toxic exposures, and have a meaningful purpose in your life.
So this is, we need to have integrative medicine.
Integrative
to play a role in heart disease.
Well, yes, for sure, but in the rest of medicine as well.
So do you think hospitals are moving toward integrative medicine?
Very slowly, and it's by patient demand. I'm in the process of working out a program for hospitals that's going to help bring integrative medicine at least to their websites so that they will be able to educate their public as to what integrative medicine is and how it works, and eventually develop a department of integrative medicine, which a lot of universities now have. You look at Duke University, my alma mater, they've got a powerful Department of Integrative Medicine. UCSF does, Stanford does, Harvard does. You aren't going to see it in many of the local hospitals. A few are starting to. California
Pacific. The patients
Pacific,
are demanding it.
They are demanding it. And so what they need is somebody who has a background in this that can provide them with some of the information like what we have on drsaputo.com, where we have more than 2,300 audios and videos that Vicki and I have made ourselves or by interviewing important people who understand integrative health.
Experts.
Experts, that's right. So we have a lot to move forward with, and I think the hospitals are going to be stuck in having to keep competitive in market share to be able to have reputations that brand them as providing all the services that people may need if they get sick.
Well, one of the things we need is for the insurance companies to get on board here.
Well, for sure, and they're starting to. Aetna is talking about it.
Because people are paying out of pocket. Not everybody can afford the alternatives.
Well, that's right, but those people that can want it, and to have other options is a really good idea, and I think that's the direction that we're moving in. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on the key to preventing moldy berries, and when we come back, we'll be talking about what kinds of stresses increase the risk for heart attacks? Stay tuned.
Berries are very delicious.
Aha.
But they're also kind of delicate. And raspberries in particular seem like they can mold before you even get them home from the market. Have you ever noticed
that?
I
sure have, yeah.
Well, there's nothing more tragic than paying over $4 for a package of local raspberries only to look in the refrigerator the next day and find that fuzzy mold growing on their insides. Well, with fresh berries just starting to hit the farmers markets, here's a tip I came across to keep them fresh. When you get your berries home, prepare a mixture of one part vinegar And it can be white or apple cider vinegar. That's probably worked the best. And 10 parts of water. So 1 part of white or apple cider vinegar and 10 parts of water. And dump the berries into the mixture and just swirl them around. And drain them and rinse them if you want, though the mixture is so diluted that you can't taste the vinegar anyway. And then just pop them in the refrigerator. The vinegar kills any of the mold spores and the other bacteria that might be on the surface of the fruit. And voila! Raspberries will last a week or more. And strawberries go almost 2 weeks without getting moldy and soft.
Well, that's really neat.
So go forth and stock up on those pricey little gems, knowing that they'll stay fresh as long as it takes you to eat them, because okay. They are very delicious and healthy.
Okay.
So, you know, we have more on heart disease. And several articles came out this week on factors that can increase the risk of a heart attack. We all know that stress is a high risk factor for heart attack. And a new Danish study now shows the importance of mental vulnerability and how it increases the risk of heart disease. And another study shows how hair analysis can predict the risk of a heart attack. And another shows that demanding physical labor, in other words, stressful physical labor on your job, can increase the risk of a heart attack. So with heart disease, the number one killer, it's important to go over this. So first, we're going to start by defining what mental vulnerability means.
Yeah, these are people who have had a lot of problems with their relationships. They're stressful, and they tend to have psychosomatic symptoms a lot. They have ulcers or back pain or headaches or problems like that that are related to stress. And in this particular study, they looked at 11,000 patients in Denmark, followed them for about 16 years, and found that the people who were the ones that had these stressful personalities had 36% more problems with heart attacks, both fatal and not fatal. So this is a big thing. And we've known, I mean, it's certainly doctors know, that the patients that are the most likely to come down with some kind of problem related to arteriosclerosis are the ones that are under a lot of stress.
Yeah, and we already know, too, that depression plays a big role in that,
for
too.
Sure. What you think has such a powerful effect on your biochemistry and physiology. There is nothing more powerful than what you believe. And that's why we have so much emphasis on this thing called the placebo effect, and also on something called the nocebo effect. Placebo means that you can do positive things by giving somebody a sugar pill or putting an idea in their mind that's very positive if they're vulnerable to that, and most of us are. And the nocebo effect is like putting a hex on somebody. It's like the voodoo thing. And that, too, has a powerful effect on our biochemistry and physiology that can lead to heart attacks and strokes and all kinds of things.
So let's talk about the heart rate variability test and why that's a good test to identify these patients.
This is a test that measures how well the heart can adapt to changes in breathing, to emotion, to physical exercise. That heart that beats like a metronome is in big trouble because it can't adapt. So when you measure heart rate variation, heart rate variability on a test, you're looking to see that there's a change in the rate at which the heart beats depending on what's happening.
Like if you're sleeping, it's going to be slower.
Well,
and if you're jogging, it's going to be faster.
It needs to be able to adapt.
If
that's
you're
right.
Stressed, it would be faster.
It might be. That's right. All those things are what you want to measure. And when you find that your heart's beating like a metronome, prepare yourself because you need an evaluation to find out how advanced this problem is for you. So it's a very inexpensive.
Can you change your heart rate variability?
Absolutely.
How would you change it?
Heart math is one way to do it. Biofeedback is a wonderful way to do it.
And we have some interviews on that on drsaputo.com.
Oh, lots of stuff on that that will help you a lot to understand that this is such a powerful tool. And it's an inexpensive test. It's the kind of thing that, you know, for $100, you can have the most predictive test in medicine tell you what your chances are for dying from all-cause mortality as well as heart attacks.
And yet this test isn't used much in mainstream medicine, is it? Is it covered by insurance?
Yes. Medicare even pays for it.
So maybe a patient could ask for it.
They could. I don't know that they will get it. Most of the cardiologists are wanting to do tests that cost a lot more. They're looking at doing cardiac echoes or doing radionuclide scans of the heart. And of course, you get more information from that. But in this era of screaming costs in healthcare, we've got to start being more reasonable.
And it might not be necessary to do those other big tests.
It isn't. If your heart rate variability test is normal, I mean, you're in good business. And if you also do what's called a vascular stiffness test along with it to see how much arteriosclerosis you have, how much stiffening of your arteries you have, see how resistant they are to flexibility, you've got really a lot of the answers that you need to determine how well this particular person you're evaluating is doing.
Okay, so there was another study, too. So how does hair analysis predict a heart attack caused by chronic stress?
Isn't that interesting? You know, we kind of poo-poo hair analysis in medicine because it's not done much, and it tends to be a test that people who do nutrition are interested in. And hair is a very important human tissue that has a lot of nutrients and chemicals and hormones and enzymes in it that are part of its structure.
Aren't they dead cells?
They are dead, but they have in it deposited these vitamins and minerals and nutrients and other things, mm-hmm. toxins like lead and arsenic and mercury, mm-hmm. that you can measure very accurately. And so when you measure for levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, cortisone, you can measure it in about a 1.2-inch sample of hair is what will grow in about 3 months.
Closest to the scalp.
Closest to the scalp or any other area you want to take it from.
So you pull it out.
On my head, you probably wouldn't get too much. So you may need to take it from another area. So that will tell you then if you analyze for cortisol in there, as was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, you can get a very good assessment of stress and look for the risk that's higher for diabetes, heart disease, stroke, peripheral arterial disease. This is a good test.
And usually we think of physical exercise as preventing a heart attack. So mm-hmm. tell us about the study showing how demanding physical work can increase the risk of cardiovascular disease as opposed to leisure activity.
Yeah, this was really interesting because demanding physical work, a lot of people would think, well, it's exercise, isn't it? It's the kind of thing that we are recommending to do in our leisure time that we enjoy, like running or playing tennis or doing some other basketball, some kind of active sport. Just jogging is a great way to prevent heart attacks and strokes and other problems that are caused by arteriosclerosis. But when you're doing physical exercise on a job that you don't particularly want to do, it becomes stressful.
Maybe like the chain gang.
Well, that'd be the worst example of it all, probably.
Or working on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, maybe. That's up pretty high.
Well,
if you're afraid of heights, that might be a little stressful.
It would add to it. They found that more sedentary jobs had a 20% lower risk of heart attack or stroke. Which
isn't
really
that
surprises us.
Yeah,
yeah. It is.
But leisure activity reduces the risk of a heart attack by
60%. That's a lot different. Yeah, they looked at 14,000 people who didn't have cardiovascular disease at the start and followed them for about 3 years and found that there was a beneficial effect from leisurely exercise because it decreased coronary events by 60%.
And leisure doesn't mean slow. It just means for healthy reasons.
Because you want to do it. This is what you do because you like to stay in shape or you like to run or you like to play tennis like I do.
But if you do this hard, demanding physical labor all day and then you think, oh, now I'm going to go to the gym and work out, that increases your risk for a heart attack by four times.
That's 400% higher. So you need to know who the person is, how they feel about what they're doing before you start recommending exercise just willy-nilly. And don't think just because you have a stressful job that you're getting enough exercise that it's going to protect you from further heart disease. So the whole symphony of what a human being is and how they react to a situation is important. So doctors need to listen to their patients. They need to tell them how they feel. They need to know the challenges they're facing in their life. They need to be holistic about it, which means looking at the inseparable nature of body, mind, emotion, and spirit and paying attention to each of those perspectives because they're important in each person's life as much as anything else.
And with heart disease, the number one killer, it's important that we understand the things that we can do to reduce our risk of heart disease. And
Absolutely.
We need to learn to partner with our doctors and take responsibility for our health.
Right. So the problem isn't us. It's usually our doctors who don't have enough time. They're working for some HMO, and the result is very disappointing. Well, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health radio, and we'll be talking about how to reduce complications in a hospital may not be what hospitals want because it costs them more money. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
What would you assume is the priority of a hospital? To take good care of their patients, right?
I would hope so.
Well, it seems that there are too many conflicts of interest when it comes to the financial end of things, because a new study shows that U.S. hospitals may have a financial incentive not to implement techniques that reduce surgery-related complications. In other words, hospitals make money off of our complications.
It's incredible, but it's true.
Yeah, is there something wrong with this picture?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that we can say that hospitals are trying to make more money if they have more complications, but how motivated are they to change this situation? I mean, that tells you the real bottom line. And if you've talked to people who are on the board of directors privately, they'll tell you that the finances of the institution are really important because if they can't pay their bills, they can't continue to provide service for the public.
Well, how much do they make when a patient has a complication?
Oh, it can be a ton. It depends on who they are, what they're getting their, what their insurance is. I mean, you can look at some people who are, for example, in Medicare. The hospital makes about $1,900 when there are no complications on surgical patients. Okay, not very much, compared to about $3,600 when patients have had one or more complications. And that's going to move in a direction where they do this thing called bundled care. Meaning what they're going to do is they're going to give a flat rate to each person that has a particular condition, and then what happens is the hospital's problem. In that setting, they're going to be inclined to want to change things a lot.
That might be better, huh?
That would definitely be better.
Well, what about when people have private insurance?
It's a whole lot different then. Then you're looking at the of amounts of money that are incredibly different. You're looking at about an average of about $11,000 per patient.
So they're gouging the insurance companies, which is why our premiums and rates go up, huh?
Well, that's right. I mean, when you look at just plain old privately insured patients who have the best, the hospitals make about $17,000 per patient, okay? And they also have about $56,000 for patients who are privately insured that have had one or more complications. So the financial incentive is not to fix things. I mean, why would you want to fix things if money is your bottom line?
And then if a person doesn't have insurance?
Oh, then there's a real problem. Then the hospitals lose money. About 10% of the people who come into hospitals are people who are on Medicaid or pay for their own surgery. In that setting, they don't make a lot of money at all. In fact, they'll lose money in that setting.
You know, if a patient has an avoidable complication, it seems that the hospital should be responsible for correcting it without charging the patient.
Well, that would be
because
one way to do it.
Because it seems like it's their fault that they got the complication.
Well, it may be their fault. I mean, sometimes complications occur. What happens if a surgeon makes a mistake? You know, he's in the abdomen and he cuts the ureter, and then all of a sudden you've got a kidney problem that's a new one, and a new surgery.
Well, certainly
involved.
Not the patient's fault. Why should the patient have to pay for that?
Well,
maybe the surgeon should have to pay for that.
That's why they carry malpractice insurance. And then the question is, what can you call malpractice?
But who pays for the patient's complication?
The insurance company usually mm-hmm. will pay for that. And if that happens, I mean, nobody's complaining except the insurance company, but they continue to do it.
Of course, then the patient ends up having to suffer, too. I mean, you know, if they have this problem or if they get an infection.
Well, keep in mind that getting sick and being in the hospital is a risk. You know, you pay your nickel, you take your chances. You look at what is the risk if you don't go in the hospital to what the risk is if you do go in the hospital. And doctors aren't perfect. Hospitals aren't perfect, and there are going to be mistakes. It's just the way it is.
So be healthy and stay out of the hospital if you can.
Well, that would be the first thing. That's right, because we need to have a system where we don't get sick. I mean, basically, we have a disease care model, which means that we wait till we get sick, then we expect to go to the doctor, and then the doctor is supposed to provide us with some magic bullet in the form of some kind of pill or some kind of technology or surgery. And that's really kind of like naive thinking. We need to work with Mother Nature, not just be arrogant and assume that what we're doing is going to be okay because we've got doctors and healthcare system.
So what's this deal about how hospitals are punished if they do quality improvement programs?
Well, I mean, if they make less money because there are fewer complications, they're just not going to get as much money. So they make a profit on that.
Well, the fact that their priority is their financial gain is just really not right. It just makes me think, like, where's the Florence Nightingale in our healthcare system?
Well, you're right. But keep in mind that hospitals do try to do the best they can for their patients.
And yet
keep in mind that the hospital board of directors is usually made of doctors in large part who are having opinions about what to do. And there's a little bit of tension between the economics of what's happening and the complications and problems people get into because the healthcare may not be at the highest level. Different hospitals have different outcomes. There are places where hospitals are rated depending on how effective their services are. And it's important for patients to know that. You wouldn't want to go have open heart surgery in some little town, you know, in Northern California, up north, because they may not be doing very many, or in some town in the remote part of Arkansas. And you may still be stuck with that because that's all there is. Healthcare is not the same every place. Doctors are not trained the same. The standards of care will vary immensely depending on how much money a hospital has that it can spend on trying to make people better.
And yet the hospitals claim to be in the red, even though they're charging these astronomical amounts of money.
Well,
they're making money off of complications. They're making money off of all these tests and scans and all that sort of thing.
It depends on the hospital. You know, if you're in a big hospital, in general, you've got a better chance to be successful. But in some of the smaller hospitals, they're going out of business because they can't make enough money. Maybe they have too many people who are on Medicaid. You know, we know that hospitals lose money on that. So if you're in an area where you are mostly treating Medicaid patients, you're looking at your county hospitals and some hospitals that are private that are trying to do a good job at providing this kind of health care.
Well, see, the other thing is that a lot of the tests are so expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't make it accessible or easy for the doctors to know the cost of the tests that they order. So tend to order more tests because they're trying to be thorough. They also want to cover themselves in case, you know, the patient ends up with something that they didn't test them for and all that sort of thing.
Well, we have to look at each person and what their situation is, each hospital, and what their financial situation is, and make the best of what might not be an optimal situation. So it's easy to be critical of hospitals, and some of them we should be critical of because they're just gouging the public. But the vast majority, I don't think, are. And just because a hospital is not a nonprofit doesn't mean they aren't making a lot of money. I mean, look what they're paying some of their CEOs. It may be millions of dollars every year.
Yeah, see, I don't like all these conflicts of interest.
Well, I don't either. And yet, that's the way the system is. And it's why we need to evolve from a disease care healthcare system to a wellness system where we do lifestyle. A healthy lifestyle is our basic thing. When you've got a lot of economics involved with surgery and with drugs and technologies, you've got a problem that's really going to take us to a place like what we're facing today in a lot of hospitals, and it's not right.
And you know, too, it's not just the money, it's the quality of life that the patient ends up with have been complications.
Well, the hospital should be geared to helping patients as the primary thing. We know they can't operate if they don't have money, but maybe in that setting they need to close down. And in that setting, you could argue, well, they may need to close down, but then they don't have any hospital at all. So a lot of it depends on economics, because that's how the system works. And we need to find a way to change some of that. Maybe bundled care is the answer. Well, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on psychiatrists or bartenders. I can't wait to hear this one. And when we come back, we'll be talking about why don't doctors care about medical costs and how do doctors learn about new drugs. Stay tuned.
Ever since I was a child, I've always had a fear of someone under my bed at night. So I went to a shrink and I told him, I've got problems. Every time I go to bed, I think there's somebody under it, and I'm scared. I think I'm going crazy. Well, just put yourself in my hands for 1 year, said the shrink. You come and talk to me 3 times a week, and we should be able to get rid of those fears. So how much do you charge? $80 a visit. Well, I'll sleep on that. Well, 6 months later, the doctor met me on the street. Well, why didn't you come and see me about those fears you were having, he asked me. Well, $80 a visit 3 times a week for a year is an awful lot of money. A bartender cured me for $10. I was so happy to have saved all that money that I went and bought me a new pickup. Well, is that so? With a bit of an attitude, he says, and how, may I ask, did a bartender cure you? Well, he told me to cut the legs off the bed. Ain't nobody under there now.
That's great.
Oh, forget the shrinks. Have a drink and talk to a bartender.
Oh, right. Or your barber. Or your hairdresser. Right?
Or your manicurist.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of psychiatry that goes into those places. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. So anyhow, you know, back to our topics here. If you don't have to pay something, do you pay attention to the cost?
A lot different when somebody else is paying the bill and they say, just get what you want.
So have you ever noticed the cost of medical and hospital expenses when you have insurance coverage? Like $5 to $10 for a Band-Aid?
That's right. What
about lab tests and scans and other treatments and medications? When you get medical expenses that are covered, do you ever dispute them or do you even care? You know, a lot of times they send you those summaries of them.
Oh, I know.
Wonder how many people really read them, or do you just toss them?
Well, that's right. I got a bill for $89,000 for my hip surgery. Okay, there were a few complications with it, but $89,000, and the insurance paid it all.
Did you go over it?
I went over it a little, but not a lot. I probably should have, although it's a big deal. I mean, if you're going to take some kind of action.
Well, what
so you've
I
got
mean
a good point.
No, but what I mean is if you see something on there that you don't think is correct, that maybe they added something that they didn't use or
you
whatever.
You look at some of the prices that's there. I mean, it's crazy. And hardly anybody reviews their bills.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say.
So, I'm with you.
So, like, I think that it's our responsibility to go over those, and if there is a discrepancy, to let the insurance company know.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, John Hopkins did a study, and it showed that doctors are oblivious to the cost of the tests and the drugs and the treatments, and that when the doctors know the cost, then they order differently.
Well, that's right. I mean, we do a lot of things just because we're, as doctors, wanting to provide the best care we can. I can remember about 25 or 30 years ago when I was deeply entrenched in the hospital with a lot of patients there in ICU and CCU. I wanted the best for my patients. I wasn't considering how much a test costs or a special procedure was or a surgery. I just did what I thought was right. And we doctors really did not take responsibility for the skyrocketing costs of health care. We backed off and said, you know, we're interested in providing care. We don't care about the money. You guys in the insurance industry, do what you want to do and take care of it. And we let the horse out of the barn as we gave the purse strings of medicine away from the control that we could have had, but now have abdicated.
So now this is what kind of created managed care. Is that what you're saying?
A lot of it was exactly why that happened, and because you had to control costs. But doctors who are probably the best qualified to determine whether a procedure needs to be done or not be done, or how urgent it is, needs to think about that. And look at the costs of care for the last year of life. About 50% of all of our health care costs are spent then. Is that a wise thing to do in terms of looking at all the health care issues we have that could be managed in a different way on people who are younger, more salvageable, and where you can get more mileage from what you do financially?
Well, it seems like the best thing, too, like when you're talking about end of life, would be to have like a team of the patient's
Definitely.
Family and the doctors to make some of these decisions. Because, you know, most people, if you talk to them, they'll tell you when they're old and when they're dying
yeah.
that they don't want to have it prolonged and they don't want all these tubes
Every
and they don't
place,
want to be
right.
those sort they of things
want to be
can
resuscitated,
make they don't,
right.
yeah, they don't want to be in a
ventilator.
A ventilator.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of these things will happen if you don't have an advance directive or you don't have some kind of family that is overseeing how care should be delivered. So when you just put it in the hands of the doctor, sometimes silly things happen. I know in the beginning of my career, we wanted to save lives at any cost. It didn't matter what the expenses were. We spent whatever was possible on those patients. As I got more seasoned as a doctor, I realized that some people needed to die. You know, they had advanced cancer. They were suffering. They didn't need to go through more pain. Or they had some other kind of thing like advanced congestive heart failure. They couldn't do anything. The quality of life wasn't right. This takes judgment and experience, and it may not seem like much, but in today's world where we're paying more attention to what the patient needs rather than we think that they need, we need to ask them and communicate.
Well, just like, for example, they were mentioning in this article a couple of different tests that doctors order, like mm-hmm. a metabolic panel. They
sure.
said it's cheaper than ordering what?
The basic one
compared to the
one that has a
comprehensive.
Yeah, well, and the amount of money they're talking about there wasn't much.
But it
still
all
looking...
added up, though, when you did it to a lot of patients.
Well,
and then they talked about a CBC with a differential and a CBC that
yeah.
wasn't.
Well, I kind of smiled when I read this because I'm looking at tests that don't cost a fortune. These are the smaller things. The bigger things, a lot of the time, need to be done. That CT scan or that MRI is going to tell you a lot about what to do. But again, it needs to be taken
well, like
into
we
perspective.
Were talking earlier about doing the heart rate variability
Absolutely.
Instead of going to the extreme of doing the echoes and all the other
right.
Tests. That
For
might
some
not be
young
necessary.
People who are, you know, have a big life in front of them, absolutely do more. But you've got to look at the cost of what healthcare is. So basically, when we're looking at a 9% reduction, okay, at Johns Hopkins Hospital in lab tests over the course of a 6-month period, that's significant, but you're looking at something like $400,000, and we're looking at hospital costs in the hospitals of millions of dollars every year. So it's a start. It's the tip of the iceberg.
Well, see, what else would be nice is maybe if they could print what the cost is on the sheet, and then
yeah.
the doctor could just sort of see that on there. But the hospitals don't really want to provide this information because they profit from the expenses
exactly.
big time.
Same thing with medicines. You know, they just assume that you ordered the most expensive medicines on the planet.
Instead of the generic, which is usually just as good. Or
well,
is.
Even it's- those, because they're going to mark them up. So if you're picking the medicines that are expensive, for chemotherapy, where you may spend $50,000 or $100,000 in a matter of a few months, that's fine with them because they're marking them up, and they're getting a return on investment there because they're being used. So they have no incentive to teach doctors about how much they're spending.
So we just keep having more and more conflict of interest.
So in this particular study that they did that was published in the journal Internal Medicine in April of 2013, they identified 62 diagnostic blood tests that were frequently ordered by doctors, and they put them in two groups. One group, they put the price of the test right next to the test.
Right.
And the other group, they didn't.
And it did make a difference.
It did make a difference. That's where you got the 9% reduction, because a lot of the time, we're just doing Cadillac care. You know, get a blood count on somebody every day because I need to know if there's something. You know, it's overdone.
Well, just like when you go to the grocery store, if there's two products that are on the shelf next to each other.
That too.
And they're both the same. A lot of times your first instinct is to grab for the one that you've seen advertised.
Right.
But if you stop for a second and you look at the prices, if you're sensible, you're going to pick the cheaper one, because if you look at the ingredients and the ingredients are the same thing.
Well,
why would you pick the more expensive one?
Well, that's right. Well, that's what doctors get used to, too. You know, we have patterns of what we do. We just order the tests. We don't worry about who's doing the test or what the cost of it
they
is.
They just
or is
figure,
there a
cheaper way the insurance company is going to pay
yeah,
for it.
Yeah, right, right. Well, the hospitals love that because that's where they get a lot of their return on investment. Because keep in mind, it's a business as well as a service.
Yeah, and then the private patients are really in trouble.
Oh, right. I mean, people who don't have insurance, they go to the hospital, they have all these tests done. The markups on the care that they get is astronomical. My bill of $89,000 that was charged to Medicare and to my supplemental insurance, I bet they paid $20 on it. Yet if a private patient goes in and they don't have insurance, the hospitals give them the $89,000 bill.
And they have to sell their house and whatever.
Well, it's not right. And we need to do something about changing policies like that. All right.
So, isn't it interesting that television commercial sponsors are required to list potential side effects from medications and the drug sales reps that visit the doctor's offices to teach the doctors about their new medications ignore the side effects much of the time because yeah. nobody checks up on them,
right.
although it's against the law not to include them?
Right.
You know, it makes me wonder why the doctors don't ask the reps what the risks are.
Yeah, well, I imagine some of them do, but they actually did a study on this to find out what actually transpired. And I have to tell you, my office would be overrun with drug reps if I allowed it. I do not allow drug reps in my office.
I know.
I don't want to get my information from somebody who's got a conflict of interest who wants to sell their drug without regard. Really, they're doing what they were hired to do, which is to convince doctors to buy the product. I mean, that's what their job is all about.
And so what happens is many times the doctors trust the drug company rep because they act like they're the ultimate authority.
Well, also, and they become friends. You know, they'll take you out to play golf, or they'll take you on a little trip, or they'll buy you dinner, and they'll put their arm around you, and they'll notice that you have a tennis racket someplace up there, and they'll start talking to you about tennis. It's like they're your long-lost friend.
Give you free samples.
Oh, all the free samples you want. Of course, if you need anything for yourself or your family, we'll provide you with anything that you want because you're our buddy. Well, give me a break. This is just business, and doctors get sucked into it. I mean, how do doctors learn about different drugs that are coming out? Unfortunately, from their drug rep.
And studies even show and prove that doctors are influenced by pharmaceutical promotions and that they're likely to start prescribing the drugs without researching them themselves.
Oh, it takes a lot of time. And where are you going to find all this information? It's going to be information that's what? Published by a drug company who did the study. We know you can't trust that because we've got so many times we've talked
biased.
About just a little bit biased. I mean, they don't publish the studies that show you what the downside of what happened. I mean, if a drug turned out to have no value, they're not going to publish that study. They somehow managed to lose them.
Which is why it's important to notice who pays for the study, who did the study, if there's a conflict of interest.
Well, all this stuff is important.
But you know what else is that there's no sanctions for misleading or inaccurate promotion by the rep.
That's really right.
And so they can just get by with telling you whatever they want.
They do.
Sell their drug. That's their job.
Okay, and what kind of person is actually hired as a drug rep? These are good-looking people who are cute, that have a nice appearance, that present themselves very well. Very often they're good-looking girls, you know, who want to just talk to you for a little while about this little drug we got coming out here, doctor. And a lot of doctors bite on that. I think you have to, I mean, the last time a drug rep came in my office had to be 15 years ago. And when
I think I was there.
What do you remember about it?
Well, she was real cute.
Yeah, she probably was.
And she just walked right in the door and went right over to the cabinet and opened it up like she was going to replenish the shelves. And she goes, What happened in here? What's all this? Because we'd gotten rid of all the pharmaceutical
drugs
and just put some supplements in there.
That's right.
And
there were a lot of supplements.
We basically told her that she didn't need to come back anymore.
Well, the drug reps haven't tried to come to my office now for probably about 15 or 20 years.
They figured it out.
Well, I mean...
If anybody listens to any of our shows or reads your book, they're going to know better.
Well, you're right about that. And then what about the FDA? Is the FDA protecting us?
Medicine's a business, and they're part of it.
They're in bed
with the pharmaceutical companies.
There are so many articles on drsaputo.com that have to do with this conflict of interest of the FDA. Just go to the site, and in the search box, put in FDA or put in Big Pharma and see all the audios and videos that come up that are short and right to the point that'll give you specific case reports of what's going on there.
But, you know, there are times when you need a medication.
Absolutely. I mean, there's an order to how we do things, and we talked about that a lot. It starts with doing things that are simple and non-invasive, and it ends with doing things that are more aggressive. So we have to draw lines there and make sure that we're doing the right thing. I want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news in health on the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
If you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. We'll see you next time.